I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, hello, and welcome to another episode of Musée and Thomas. My name is Chase Thomas, and I'm up there in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I'm a sports writer, not a film critic, not a film director, but this guy on the other end down there in my old neighborhood in Atlanta, Snow Mountain, Georgia, Philip Musée. Philip, good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening, Chase. It's been a little while.
We had to take a break. I took a week off, and then I had some traveling I had to do, so I did not like it. So here is because of my insanity, Philip.
You're insane?
Yes, 100%. And I hate not working. I love the idea of taking breaks. I love the thought of just being like, you know what? I'm just going to sit in bed all day, take my mind off work and school and everything, and it's going to be delightful. Like, I'm looking at a blue jay out my window right now.
Of course.
He's just hanging out. I wish I could just sit there, have some tea, watch this blue jay, read my books, and be fine. I can't do that.
So your life sounds like a wonderland.
It sounds...
Well, why can't you do that?
I mean, this is why we were talking before we started recording, the whole therapy thing, where, I mean, these are questions for a future therapist. Let's say a prayer right now, folks, for my future therapist, because the stuff that we have to unpack and get through here, it's not great. And I just can't not think about the podcast, think about my writing, think about the website, think about all these different things that I'm working on. I can't stop thinking about school. I can't stop thinking about what Tennessee's depth chart is going to look like tomorrow. There is so much that I can't not think about, so there is no rest for me, and it scares the shit out of me, honestly. But I'm not capable, so my nerves have been like really fried as of late. How are you?
Well, how are you doing? I'm just peachy, Chase. I'm great.
How do you even respond to that?
No, I look, man. I mean, I think as fellow writers, right? I see writing as a form of therapy.
When you're writing about yourself,
in fact, well,
like my newsletter I did 2 weeks ago was probably the most soothing article I've ever written by far.
Soothing.
Mm-hmm. Like I felt less stressed as I was writing through it, because I was very, I don't know how you are about this, but writing personal stuff always scared me. I was like, let's just keep those doors closed. Let's keep those gators just very much down there in the depths of your stomach. Let's not bring those out.
Yeah, and, don't let the wolves out of the pen.
Yeah, whichever metaphor you prefer. And
I prefer the, just by way of example, if we're going to go there, I prefer don't let the scary adolescent clown out of the cage in the basement of my mind.
I like that it was short, sweet, easy to get through. I think we should
terrify
that one. Yeah,
It's a nightmarish image, and I want that to stick with everyone. No, but I was thinking that this, what you're saying actually reminds me of, ironically, Bernadette. You know, when she stopped doing what made her feel like she had passion in life, right? As being an architect, she just became a menace to society.
She didn't even realize she was suicidal. Like, that was the thing. It's like they didn't even come to her mind. But the therapist is like, the person you're describing is not happy, and very much not happy, to the point where she doesn't know what the point of any of this is anymore.
And it's,
I'd probably go the same way.
Right. But I think it's that point in time where you just gotta go ham on some like
cigarettes?
Moose tracks or cigarettes. I don't know. Who knows anything, really?
I've thought about that a lot, actually. I think I might pick cigarettes back up.
Well, I've seen you in your Insta stories, not only smoking cigarettes out of your, it's in the public domain here, so smoking cigarettes after a biting Falcons loss.
I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Musée. I apologize. I would never encourage Philip to do anything of the sort.
No, this is all you. I'm just relaying your life to the people. Oh, and then perfect. I saw you waste a perfectly good mango White Claw. You just got it everywhere. Like, it just spilled.
No, I did not. She did, because that person in particular bit like half, like this crater hole into the, like in the can where it spilled out. There's no way to chug it in a, any efficient manner.
Don't you hate when that happens?
Yeah. I'm also too old for all of that. I realize too.
I realized while I was watching it. Yeah, you're definitely too old for that.
Okay.
But so am I.
Okay, you don't have to agree with me that.
No, but so am I. So like I was watching it and I thought to myself, even when I did that in college, I was still too old for that.
Mm-hmm.
Or young for that. Or
that,
I don't know.
That life passed us by.
That life never wanted us. I think
it's true. Because we are on the same wavelength here, where we're like, we're kind of like the outsider type. We are too old for this, since we were like 12 years old, where we were always just kind of into the stuff that no one our age was into, right?
Yeah, I read Camus to make myself feel better.
Yes. Like, I have the stranger sitting right behind me.
That's good. It's like
with
a yearly thing.
74-year-old retired Emory professor when I was a senior in high school, and she's still one of my best friends today.
That's
awesome.
She was
the last person I saw before I left.
I saw that. Yeah, you had you went and had coffee or something, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Dr. Frances Grossman. She is my favorite human being on this planet.
Shout out.
Yeah.
I could see you being a really, really great English professor. I don't know if that's what you want.
I mean, that is one of the things I want to do. Yes.
Yeah. No, I would take your classes.
That is part of the reason I want to get my PhD, is I want to be an adjunct professor in the English department.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think...
You take my class,
I would take your class, but I think I would end up resenting you, because I don't think you'd ever give the grade that I felt that I deserved. But it's...
I think you might end up resenting me on this podcast anyway.
No.
If we spend enough time together, who knows? I think that's how it works with me.
Is that why you made this the 5-hour edition? Is that why we're gonna...
So I'm intentionally sabotaging.
I could see
my
that.
My friends called me Bojack. I have a lot of Bojack Horseman in me, 100%.
So you're what is he, like a Hollywood agent or something?
No. You would love Bojack Horseman. It's one of my favorite shows of all time. Like, Bojack is the realest animated show ever created.
Besides Rick and Morty?
Oh, more than Rick and Morty. It's not even close.
Interesting.
It is... Basically, he was a child prodigy star actor and that was it. Like, he peaked in his younger years, and he's living in Hollywood with nothing really going on. It's kind of like Bernadette, because we bring everything back around to Bernadette, where
everything is Bernadette.
Everything is Bernadette, where he just has nothing to do. He just has all this money. He lives the life, and he is just depressed as hell, and he didn't have a family. He didn't do the stuff that he wanted to do. He already peaked, and he knows he peaked, and he doesn't really know how to finish out his life, and it doesn't go well. You're not going to believe
how many seasons are there.
I think five or six.
Okay. And is it finished? Like,
yes, it finished last year, and it, the ending is just as like, it's just honest and it's brutal, and there's some really, really biting lines in this, and just forgiveness is a big thing in this series, and why it doesn't always go the way it should, and whether or not you should open old wounds. I mean,
you should open old wounds.
No, you should not.
Oh, should not. Okay.
And how it affects other people, and just, he is this tornado of just self-loathing that just destroys everyone around him, because it's like Bernadette, where because she doesn't have her thing, she's terrible for everyone around her. And yeah. If she's not doing that thing that makes her great, then it's not good.
It raises an interesting question about the role of film and television, that I was reading about earlier this week. This idea, especially that because we're all in isolation, or the majority of the world is in isolation, or, you know, quarantining, are film and television designed to be a mechanism of escape, where you're able to kind of put down the rudimentary details of your life and get out into someone else's world? Or is it meant for us to go into ourselves in a way that we wouldn't otherwise? So a film like Bernadette, you know, I've personally been thinking about it a lot over the past month, because I see myself in many of her character traits. But at the same time, I guess overall, it hasn't been the pleasant sort of escapist thing that watching a film usually is, right? It's not like a Michael Bay flick where you're just like, oh, let me just watch explosions for 2 hours.
Yeah.
This was more like, let me search for meaning within myself, because I identify with so many flaws of the main character.
Yeah.
It's an interesting dynamic for sure. So interested to hear what your thoughts are on the film this week. We've got to set this up well, because this is a film that everyone should watch 100%.
I highly agree. And I haven't had a conversation with this film with any other people. How did you learn about this movie? How did you come across that this was something that you should see?
Yeah, this has been on my list for a long time. Mm-hmm. This film won the Grand Prix at Cannes back in 2018. And I believe it played at the New York Film. I'm pretty sure it played at the New York Film Festival that same year. I had tickets to it. If I'm remembering correctly, I had tickets to it, but there were like four or five movies that I just didn't have the time to go see. And I think this is one of them. And one of my really great friends who I used to work with, raves about this film. It was one of our top three films of 2018. And we talk about films all the time. I'm happy that you had a chance to watch it, and let's get into it.
Okay. So the movie we're doing this week is Shoplifters. It's a Japanese movie, set in 2018. This movie, you know how Bernadette had that, cause we have to bring everything back on this podcast. The last 40 minutes to an hour is very happy. And they flip things, and you're like, you're moving the right direction. That's not what happens in Shoplifters. The longer this movie goes, the more depressing it gets. And there's a lot of twists where I don't know if you were picking up on this, where they don't. There's a lot of innuendos. There's a lot of ambiguity as to the nature of the family in this movie. And that is the biggest theme, is what makes a family. There's a conversation at the beach between the grandmother and one of the daughters in what contentment is and picking your family, and that it almost would be better for us all to pick our own family. And what you don't really realize at this point is that everyone in this particular impoverished family is that they all chose each other. And we learn a lot more as the film progresses about how they all came in contact with each other and how they all have learned to coexist and how they all the pieces fit. It still is just remarkable that this all works and that this all functions and this all, they all care for each other to this extent. And the movie is called Shoplifters, but that is a misnomer, because the first thing we see is, so we just see at the beginning where the father and the son have this Morse code type deal going on in shoplifting in this convenience store.
Yeah.
And they're trying to make the moral case for why they're doing it, in that it's not, no one's bought these items yet, so it's not actually stealing. And there's a lot of ethical questions throughout this movie of, do you take this girl from her family, even though her family is burning her, beating her? Like, do you, what gives you ultimately the right to steal this girl from her family to give her a better life, in your opinion? But it's still, is that the ethical choice? Is it the ethical choice to go see your ex-dead husband's affair, whatever you want to call this, with the son, and take the money and pretend to care?
Ex-lover. Yeah.
And there's just so many ethical quandaries in this movie, but this is part of the working class experience. This is part of making choices that most people don't have to make. But some of this was self-inflicted, as we learn later in the movie. But I thought it was pretty fascinating that they called this Shoplifters, because I think you're not going to believe this. There's a lot of metaphors, in my opinion, here.
Well, we got to hear about the metaphors. I misspoke earlier. The film didn't win the Grand Prix. It won the top prize at Cannes, the Palme d'Or. I think every question that you raise is completely relevant. There's such back and forth that happens just in terms of how the film fluctuates between drama and comedy, in my opinion, right? Like, I think depending on how you read this, this very well could be just like a heartbreaking kind of chamber drama that deals with the question of family, or it could be this sort of lighthearted take at times, right? It's not lighthearted throughout the whole thing. But a lighthearted take on what folks need to do to survive as a result of the inequality that persists in many advanced countries. So in a nutshell, the film is really a drama and crime story about, you know, a dysfunctional makeshift family that lives in this kind of hovel in the middle of a middle class suburb in Tokyo. And they survive by shoplifting. The patriarch,
well, not just shoplifting. They're all working. They're day laborers in different in one, the wife in dry cleaning, or just like some sort of,
yeah, she works at like an industrial cleaning plant. Yeah.
And then he is some sort of
construction
work.
Yeah. But that's all to say that shoplifting sub, I would say that supplements their income, right?
They're subsidizing their workforce, their work time.
which is unfortunate, right? I think there's probably some amount of tragedy and comedy that is inherent in that idea. But Hirokazu Koreeda, the director, really, I think this was his 13th feature. He's made documentaries and fiction films. His films usually focus on this idea of what it means to be a family, right? And obviously everyone in this this makeshift family is not necessarily related, right? And when you get into the film, you realize that despite the camaraderie that exists on the screen, despite the ginormous acting that these kids are doing in occupying such beautiful takes on the screen by themselves, this is a group of effectively people who have no biological ties to one another, but they act as a family. And so things capitulate in I wouldn't call it tragedy so much as an affirmation of what probably would have happened in real life. I think this film is really true to life. Overall, I would say this film to me was a beautiful sort of walk through a museum. It didn't feel so much like I was watching a movie so much as watching a bunch of incredibly crafted vignettes that all came together to tell a story of what it means to exist or to scratch and scrounge for survival in the modern age. So we can start from a lot of places here, but I guess I'm just kind of curious to one, hear from you, what was, and I think you just watched this, but what stood out to you just in terms of the craft of this film that we haven't seen in, and the other films that we've seen thus far?
I think it does a very good job of following along, where the camera work in this movie is extremely strong, where mm-hmm. One of the biggest themes of this movie, I think, is just this, how limited in space they are. They're all crowded in this tiny living community mm-hmm. with all these different people, and that they have to make this tough choice to bring in this little girl. She is stuck in a balcony, locked out and in a tight space, and he's getting in this tight elevator, tight car, riding to work. Like, I think they do a very good job of just exposing how on top of each other everybody is throughout mm-hmm. the entirety of this movie, and just how constricted their lives are, both just in their own minds, but also in their day-to-day life. They're just, I think the camera work did a really good job of following along and just letting these actors just be humans. And it does a really good job of humanizing. Like, it's amazing how good of a job the two children did in this movie.
Right. Right.
I was stunned at how good they were.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were acting at all, no. To be honest. And I think that's one of the amazing things. I recently watched like Father Like Son. I think that was the feature that Koreeda did right before this one. And he works with children a lot. And that film had two of the main characters were children. And the one thing that I noticed between that film and this one is that he likes to shoot these really, really long exposed takes where he kind of just lets the actors do their work. There are so many immersive scenes in this film, Shoplifters, that bring us into, I would say, the hearts of each of these characters in a way that doesn't feel like there's a screen in between us. Like, I kind of almost felt like I was in that cramped space, right? I felt like I was in, yes. in so many of those kind of close quarters, whether it was, you know, inside of this kind of sliding wall panel bedroom that one of the children lives in, there was such an invitation through the craft of this film into the story that I think for me made it really immersive. And on top of that, I mean, it's shot in 35mm. So it right away, it gives it this immediate kind of classic film look. But this film is pretty high up there in terms of the most patient films I've ever seen. And I don't know if you felt that way, because I was almost kind of, I had to adjust to the pacing of this director. I mean, he would have, I don't know, one scene in particular that comes to mind is there was a high angle shot where, Osamu, the father figure, and Shota, the son, are playing in a park. They're playing tag in a parking lot. And the scene is this gorgeous kind of deep blue color. It's nighttime. I think this some snow is coming down, and it's just this kind of high angle that focuses on the activity in that scene for, I would say, upwards of, like, it felt like probably 2 or 3 minutes. I'm sure it was only maybe like 30 seconds or 45 seconds, but that is a decision I think is very characteristic of the sensibility of this director. I mean, he's not in a rush at all to convey his points. There are shots that feel kind of like these landscape portraits. And when you watch this film, one of the most amazing things about it is that there's movement and probably movement of the camera and probably almost every shot, which shows how much artistry and intentionality went into the making of this, because there may be a scene where there's no dialogue. There's, there may just be a close up on a character, but you can very just sort of imperceptibly feel the camera sliding either into the shot or into the main character or off to the side. And having been on sets and knowing how long it takes to set up rails and how long it takes to this is getting technical, so sorry, but how long it takes to be intentional about moving the camera ever so slightly, that takes a film that you could film, or sorry, a scene that you could shoot handheld, right? Like if you just get a cinematographer in there and the camera person is holding the camera, you shoot the scene, you get the angles that you want, you shoot your coverage, and then you're done, and boom, that's like 10 minutes for let's call it a 30 second scene. Whereas with what they decided to do in many of these shots are to set up the mechanisms to create these artistic and flowing movements of the camera that add a tremendous amount of time onto each scene. So 100% agree with you that the camera work was amazing. 100% amazing.
Who do you think stood out the most in this movie? Who were you drawn to the most?
I gotta be honest. I think so. Osamu, who's the father figure, who played by Lily Frankie, who Carita has worked with in the past. I wasn't quite sure what to make of him at first. I wasn't quite sure of what to make of his character. From the very first scene that you mentioned, the title sequence is essentially Osamu and Shota, the little boy, you know, using their system of hand signals to steal from this grocery store. And it feels like this kind of Pink Panther style heist. Let me plug my computer in really quick, 2 seconds. It feels like this Pink Panther style heist, and it's cute, right? It's like this you've got this literally this little kid acting like a professional jewel thief, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's and you can see Osamu is the one enabling him, right? And so right off the bat, you can tell, okay, well, this is kind of a skeevy guy. Like he's essentially taking advantage of this child to steal things from a grocery store. And there's this one scene later on in the movie, not to jump around, but in response to, you know, what the character of this guy really is, you know, when they get caught, as they inevitably do, they're in the police station and he's being interrogated and asking, well, why did you use these kids to shoplift? And he says something along the lines of, well, what else was I going to teach them? And that is the line that I think sums up the ethos of this film quite nicely, because it is a tale of the haves and the have-nots. And you begin over the course of this film to really sympathize with Osamu's character from the very beginning. I mean, with obviously that shoplifting scene to the next sequence where they obviously find the little girl who's hungry and he offers her I think it was a dumpling and they bring her home and he just acts like it's a casual thing, like of course we're gonna help this little girl and you know it's too cold to bring her back that night.
It shows the moral dilemma of this guy who just spent the afternoon shoplifting is also extremely concerned about kids and is willing to, even though he knows that they're impoverished and they can't really take care of this girl, that like it the right thing to do, because they've seen her out on that balcony before locked out, is to bring her in. Like,
yeah,
it turns out human beings are complicated, Philip.
It turns out humans are complicated. It's true. It's true. This is one of those family dramas that I think is it's very realistic, right? Even though the scenarios is probably the scenario itself of there being a makeshift family hiding in the middle of your neighborhood, right? That is cheating and stealing to survive. Right. And we haven't even gotten to the biggest plot twist, which is, you know, the fact that Osamu and Nobuyu have, you know, they killed the grandmother's husband because he was just not a good guy. So right. they killed him so that she could essentially be free of him, and she allowed them to live in her house, right? So
right.
Technically they're murderers.
Right? It's not even technically. Like, no. There's no technically. They're actually murderers.
Yeah. They're actually murderers, but they're nice people, you know? Like you watch how Osamu takes the kids to the beach, and you watch how endearingly he tries to take care of them, and it's very touching. It's very heartfelt.
It's hard to believe that they are capable of that.
Right.
Because all we see from them is kindness, gentleness for the most part. Mm-hmm. And that scene with Nobuyu and Yuri is mm-hmm. where they burn the clothes and they're teaching her, this is not what people do. If they love you, this is what people do. Yeah. And like teaching that girl those things. They also kind of speak to their own issues, because I think they talk about Yuri at one point in this movie where they grew up in a similar situation with mm-hmm. parents who didn't want them.
Right.
And they won't turn out, or she won't turn out like them. And that like was a hint that I don't think we saw coming, right? Because they're just saying like she's not capable of what we were. And they just live with it. It's kind of amazing that they live with it. And then when the grandmother passes, to just bury her under the house so they can keep collecting the money is dark, but that moment where
what else do you do?
I mean, there's nothing else you, I guess, I mean, there are other things you can do, but like you understand the moral quandary that they find themselves in. But just when they, when the father speaks to the son and it's just like, you have to pretend she was never there. She was never here. And that's just a lot of emotional strength is required to survive in this household.
Right.
Emotional fortitude, maybe.
Yeah. That's required from a very young age.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the other plot twist is who the son is and how they came to bring him into the home. Because there were little things where it becomes clear with a key. Once that was like out there where you see the picture and you realize who she is and that she's very much not in Australia as her parents, as her parents think, that no one in here is related. No one in here is one and the same. And just the fact that they're able to, there's a grandma where he's just like, you can call me dad. And he's like encouraging him to say dad and he won't do it.
Yeah.
You don't know that that's going to be a big moment until the end.
Until the end. Yeah. Yeah, it's... Look, so those are. I'm glad we got the sad parts out of the way, right? I mean, there are.
I don't
many
think that's
more
all the sad
vignettes.
Parts. We're probably missing like 19 other sad parts in this movie.
Yeah, there are definitely more vignettes in this film that tug at the heartstrings. as long as we're on the topic, one of the most memorable scenes to me was when Aki, was in the, I guess the pleasure house, and you know she has to basically like put herself out there sexually for the pleasure of men behind this kind of glass pane, and she convinces one of the patrons to like pay to have a short session where she just kind of talks to him and like holds him. And and in that scene, the guy, I thought this was really well done, because we don't quite know who this man is, nor what his deal is in terms of the context of the film. But you know, it turns into this amazing display of humanity between two people that I think I've seen one of the most amazing that I think I've seen on screen in a long time. Because you know, he clearly has a speech impediment, and he's struggling to just kind of express himself, and Aki just kind of holds him there, right? And there's this irony that what was supposed to be this kind of sexual experience actually ended up being something that was much more tender and human. And we see Aki's, whereas before we had seen Aki's, I guess you could call it, promiscuity on display. In this scene, we're shown her extraordinary capacity for just being a human, which I think lies within all of us, and I would even venture to say was the point of this scene, you know, to show that everyone is capable of caring for another person regardless of what we've done in our past. And I think that's probably one of the greatest themes of this film overall.
What do you think is the ultimate theme of this movie? What was the takeaway we were supposed to have as viewers?
I think when it comes to family, there's this line that you mentioned where they suggest, one of the characters suggests that, well, potentially, I think Nobuyo suggests that it would be better if we could choose our own families. Most of the time, that's That's not true. If not exclusively all of the time, that's not true, and barring an extenuating circumstance. So what we're left with is this idea of, well, since we can't choose our families, we can nevertheless choose how we interact with them and how we show up for them. And I think a scene that's emblematic of that idea is at the very end, where, you know, Shota, after all of the kind of shit hits the fan, and Nobuyu takes the blame for the murder and the hiding of the body. She takes the blame because Osamu has a record, and she wants to make sure that he doesn't go to jail for the rest of his life. After all that is kind of, the dust has cleared. Shota is put in an orphanage, and one day he takes a bus all the way across town to where Osamu is living, and they spend the whole day together. And this was after Osamu got caught by the police and found out that I think by that point he knew that Osamu knew who his real parents were. But nonetheless, he chose to come across town and to spend a day with him. That I think took a lot of courage and took a lot of strength, right? And of course, that situation ends with him getting on a bus and Osamu chasing after the bus, knowing full well that he probably will never see him again. That connection, where, you know, Shota showed up for this man who treated him like a son, was really, really touching. And I think we all have an opportunity to be there for those in our family in that type of way. What do you think? What was the biggest kind of thematic theme or thematic element of this movie that you walked away with?
Uncertainty is just a part of life, in that we're all doing the best we can, and the moral compass stuff sounds great in theory, but in practicality, life is messy, and it's especially messy when you're impoverished and you have to make more difficult decisions. But I also think it's that, and also the innate human desire to have a family of your own, mm-hmm. where everyone in here really wants their family, and they don't really, they're all just kind of been betrayed by their family or not wanted, or their family did not work for them, the family that they grew up with. And they all came together because they'd all been hurt or something else, whether it was an affair, whether it was just bad relationship at home, abuse, whatever it is, there's still this desire, this thing that you want to belong to something, and that they were all better by belonging to each other, and they were far worse, and they were apart.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was important.
And it's true. I hadn't thought about it. Yeah, they were clearly all better when they were together. Now it seems that they're all kind of miserable. I mean, Nobuyu's in prison, Osamu's alone, Shota is in an orphanage, and Yuri is back in her abusive parents' apartment.
Mm. But I thought it was important they did that, because life does not work like that, and it's not a fairy tale, and that their life was not sustainable. Like, that group, they didn't see it, I don't think, at the time. I really think they believed that this was a sustainable long-term family model, and it obviously was not.
Is that an admission of you wanting to prove that the model works if you try to try this?
No. I am not. I don't think I fit that mold where I am. My instinct is to contract, not to expand in this area.
To contract. You just want to be a fly on the wall
100%.
For science. You want me to do this and report back.
Yeah, I think you're a lot more well-adjusted than me.
Well, I guess that remains to be seen.
I don't know. My inclination is to pull back with stuff like this. And I've never been like, you know what I wish? I had like 7 people in my house at all times. I've never had that instinct.
Not even around the holidays?
No.
Well, especially around the holidays. Yeah.
I get exhausted around multiple people. I think that's why like sober chase around a plethora of human beings is a very stressed out chase.
Sober chase around people, many people, just not a good combo.
No, it's not.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yes.
By not ever inviting you to anything.
Yes. Keep it limited, Philip. Keep it limited.
Keep it limited.
It's just, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's social anxiety, but it's more, I am just so comfortable alone.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I don't know.
There's nothing wrong with that at all.
It's a bad habit, though. It's a bad, it scares me that I'm almost 30 and that, like, my default is still push everyone away for 3 weeks when I'm feeling nervous or stressed. Mm.
Yeah. It's one way to be human, you know? I don't think it's anything that I as your podcast partner should prescribe anything for, but definitely maybe talk through it with someone. or if you're a true novelist, I don't know if you write fiction, but maybe you could
perhaps
hash it out with some of your characters that you create.
Very, very possible, Philip. Very possible. Did you have anything you would like to add before we wrap up here?
No. I really can't. I don't think my words can do justice to this film. This is a really special film that I think everyone should see. If not because it's very deep, definitely because it's just genuinely entertaining and thought-provoking. So check it out when you have a second. It's streaming on Hulu.
And it's very good.
Yes, I'm
glad you made me do this because I don't think I would have watched this if you did not.
Well, on that note, what's next? I think it's your turn.
It is my turn. And I've been going back and forth on what I want to do here, but I think I know.
What are we doing?
I think we're going to go something that might be more up your alley, but something that I will never watch if we don't do it on this podcast.
Okay.
Spider-Man Into the Universe.
Okay, I've seen it, but we can do that.
I have not seen it, and it's been on my list, and I've heard great things
about it. Into the Spider-Verse?
Yeah, Into the Spider-Verse, and I've heard great things about it, and I was like, huh, but I've never gotten to that point where I was like, all right, let's do it. So that is something I thought about where I was like, I want to do something light. We've done a lot of heavy stuff lately. Let's do something light.
We have, yeah. Yeah, we have. Well, you might be sorely wrong about this lighthearted thing, believe it or not.
Well,
I'm just kidding. It's a pretty light movie.
That's the nature. I mean, I went back and forth between this and Batman the Killing Joke, but I'd already seen it, and I didn't know if you'd seen it yet. That's on...
Wait, which Batman?
The Killing Joke. It's based on the graphic novel, The Killing Joke.
No, I have not seen
that. It's very good. I mean, we could do that instead if you'd rather do that, because you haven't seen it. Either Wait, way, is that... it'll be one of us have seen it and one of us have not. What would you rather?
No, it's your show, man. What do you want to do? It's your choice.
Here's what I don't we can know. Do. Here's what is we can it... do.
Yeah.
We can do them both.
Okay, that works.
But not this next week. No, no, no. But I'm Double saying feature. We can eventually hit them both.
The Killing Joke. Okay, that works.
So what do you want to do this week? Or next week, excuse me. Batman, the thing that you haven't seen, or do you do the following week, Spider-Man?
Let's do Spider-Man the following week.
Okay.
So we'll do the Killing Joke this week.
Yes, let's do some lighthearted Batman and Spider-Man stuff.
I don't ever think I've heard anyone use the words lighthearted and Batman in the same sentence.
Well, I've got bad news. Batman the Killing Joke is not lighthearted.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I also love Batman graphic novels. Like, I'm a big graphic novel guy, and I very much enjoy this one. So
let's do it.
That's what we'll do. All right. Philip Musay. We'll talk to you next week. Follow you on Twitter at Philip Musay. Follow me at Chase_Thomas. Go to ChaseMustPodcast.com. Watch Philip's videos on Instagram and YouTube. Is your YouTube handle, Philip Musay?
Mildly Concerned Citizen. Three words.
Mildly
Concerned Citizen.
Okay.
Check it out. And that's PHILIPMUSEY.
That is correct. I should probably clarify on that because, yeah, most people will stumble over that. But a very important note nonetheless. Philip Musay, always a pleasure, good sir. We will talk next week.
Thank you, sir.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.